But when we're going to be looking from a consumer perspective now, obviously we have ongoing cost of living concerns, geopolitical factors, climate change, especially on the insurance sector, market volatility. You know, how is all this affecting the financial institutions and how we should all respond to it? I would also throw in, obviously, we heard a lot about cyber attacks, ads, but also social media and government interventions into this. And I would like to say, obviously, the media sector also occasionally struggles with trust issues too, as we found out in the last couple of days from other parts of the world. So I'd like to invite to the stage Alan Kirkland, Commissioner for ASIC, Erin Turner, CEO of Consumer Policy Research Centre, and also the incoming Chair of ASIC's Consumer Consultative Panel, Michelle Levine, CEO of Roy Morgan, and Steve Johnston, Group Chief Executive and MD of Suncorp. Please invite them to the stage. So thanks for joining us. And this was touched a little bit on in the first plenary session, actually, but it might just be worth ask you all from your different perspectives, because we've got a great spread of expertise here. Where is the current state of consumer trust in financial services, and effectively, what does it mean for companies' regulation and how you view the world? And start with you, Alan.
Oh, look, I mean, that sounds like a data question, which is probably one for Michelle. But I think I just looking at incidents that cause significant issues around trust, I think if you look across the last decade or so, we had the issues around banking that led to the Royal Commission and were prosecuted through that Royal Commission. Undoubtedly an impact on trust in banking, but also a broader range of institutions. In insurance, issues around claims handling, particularly after the really major events that we saw in early 2022. And I think as a looming issue, if you look at super, the work that we're doing on high-risk super switching practices, while they're sort of largely happening, the harm is happening in particular bits of super in sort of platform products and to some extent in SMSFs. The harm that we're seeing has the potential to have an impact on trust across the super sector. So I think it's always useful to think about what are those big issues that happen or that are emerging that can have an impact on trust. And then the question is, what can we as regulators and as what can firms active in the industry do to try and stop those forces or at least mitigate the impacts on trust?
Sure.
Can I say I think the most important thing is distrust? We talk a lot about trust, and that's important, but it's distrust that is actually the killer. So everything I talk about will be framed from the danger or the risk of distrust. And nationwide, we were going to have a slide, but I don't think we've got a slide. So it's Roy Morgan without slides. So, so nationwide and across the board, we basically are now more distrusting than trusting. As a group, as a people. So what we've been doing at Roy Morgan since about 2017 is monitoring which brands and companies people trust, which ones they distrust. Around 2017 and 18, we were in the green. There were more people trusting organisations of all kinds than distrusting. Now we are in the red. So there are more organisations and brands and companies and institutions distrusted than trusted. We think that that makes Australia a fragile nation. And in the financial industry, it's a slightly different picture, because when we began in 2017, the financial institutions were really, really low. They were right in the level of distrust. We were right in the middle of the inquiry. Bank bashing was a national sport. So, you know, that was where it was. During COVID, the banks in particular, you know, the major banks and the brand banks were able to step up, be able to help people and do what was needed, insurance organisations. That created an opportunity for many of these organisations to do the right thing, and they did. But since then, it slipped away. But as we speak today, the big four are back, big four banks are back in trusted territory, and the financial industry as a whole, like the people who say, when we say, who do you distrust, they say all the banks, all financial industry. So there's still large number of people that say they distrust banks in general, insurance companies in general. Not many people say, I trust banks, I trust insurance companies. They'll trust the Commonwealth Bank, but they won't trust the banking sector in total.
That's interesting. How do you find it, Steve?
Yeah, I obviously I think the word fragile comes to mind. I think the Hayne Royal Commission was a big wake-up call for the whole financial services sector. And just give you one reference point. Before I was the CEO of Suncorp, I was the CFO. I used to do road shows around the world, and I got to Chicago. I sat down with an investor, and the road show was pretty formulaic. They talk about the profit and loss statement, the balance sheet, the capital level, and out the door. And I sat down with an investor in Chicago, and the first question, this is before the Royal Commission, they said was, Steve, can you tell me why Suncorp exists? I was sort of looking through my notes to see, find that question, I hadn't been prepared for that question. It's an incredibly difficult question to answer. And I think like most other financial services executives at the time, the way I answered it was, we exist to deliver value for shareholders. And as every word came out of my mouth, I realised that cannot be why we exist. And so no surprise that we got what we got at the Royal Commission. Now, I think the whole financial services sector has lifted up since that time, but we're by no means perfect. And I think, as I mentioned, claims handling out of the 2022 flooding events across the country really were another wake-up call, and sitting in front of the parliament, which is not a pleasant experience, is another wake-up call. So I'd say fragile. I think we've made steps forward, but we've got a lot more work to do.
But Aaron?
I'm going to be in furious agreement with my co-panelists here. Overall, my answer is improved, but you can't take your eye off this trust issue. Now, I've been a consumer advocate for some time. You could say I was a national star in the sport of bank bashing during the Royal Commission. But we've got to keep in mind that there were real serious issues that were being dealt with. And we have seen, I think, deep work from the financial system. We've seen improvements, and I want to recognise that, particularly around the way some major institutions have focused on who are they there for, how do they treat their customers, and efforts, I think, that have been really serious to address things like mis-selling and incentives. But again, these are things we can't take our eye off. I guess my word of caution is there are big issues that mean that people can lose trust in a system overall, even if it's from a few players. First Guardian, Shield, Master Trusts, we need to keep in mind. These are incidents that make people go, can I trust that my retirement savings are safe? But even more than that, I've been looking at the excellent Roy Morgan data, and there's some interesting data around the financial services system in terms of where people say they don't trust banks. What I took from that data is it's where people get a sense that fees are excessive and consumers are being charged more compared to the profits being made. It's not that they're anti-profit, but they have this sense of unfairness when it comes to fees. And we're seeing incidences where large institutions, I'm going to call the Commonwealth Bank out here, are choosing not to refund customers, even when there is a sense of unfairness, like being charged fees, or people on very low incomes being charged fees on basic banking, or what should have been basic bank accounts. These are the things that build up that cause people to lose trust in a sector. So work to do. You can't say that Royal Commission, it's over, we're a trusted sector, but definitely improved.
Very good. And I think Michelle's slides will be available, distributed through the app later. So for your perusal, I think they will, I've been told. You heard it here first. So you mentioned COVID there, Michelle, but Aaron's made a very good point there about, I guess, where we are in the cycle on financial services, with huge profits, huge valuations, and often huge remuneration as well. I mean, are there other factors that are driving that distrust specifically in financial services? Because it does strike me what you said about the Big Four sort of, regaining grounds, but yes, the overall industry being, a bit on the nose for a lot of consumers. I'd be just interested to hear sort of how that's playing out in that sort of post-COVID era.
I think what we have to realise is that the financial institutions, the financial industry, is just one microcosm of Australia and of everything. And I think we know, but maybe we forget, we're starting to forget, COVID changed everything. COVID meant that we as people, we lost certain privileges, we lost freedom, there were rules made that we had to follow, and we did, then we were disappointed. So COVID was a real game changer in terms of trusting anyone that you normally would trust. The people we would normally trust year in, year out, medical profession, police, you know, all of those sorts of good people, and even those people. So we were sort of shattered during COVID. So we approached the next phase, which is what you might call the cost of living crisis phase, already with a sense of scepticism. And so that's a really important thing. And the banks, while they did great things and were really loved by those people during COVID for the things they did, you know, there's a time that comes when you do actually have to start paying your mortgage back. And, you know, that was a really difficult thing for people, particularly when it came with the cost of living crunch. So the other thing we're seeing, and it's not just banks, it's across the supermarkets, it's across essentially any large company that announces profits. Profit triumphalism is a killer. So what's happened, you know, after COVID, we've moved into this cost of living phase where people are either struggling, we in this room are not struggling, but we all know people who are, and we all feel for those people who are, and yet you've got organisations, you know, brazenly talking about the huge profits that they've made. And coming back to your point, which is about, you know, shareholder value, it's like for the first time we as a nation are starting to look at people like me and shareholders and profit triumphalism. So it's a really, really delicate balance that we're playing in. And there's one more thing I think that we need to be aware of, may not be really specifically related to the financial institutions, but there's over 1 million Australians who are so disenfranchised, disaffected with the whole of society, with the political parties, with the government, with the big corporations. These are like those, you know, the crazy people in America. They're those people who don't believe that the laws are for them. They don't apply to them. They don't believe that the future holds anything for them. And that is an incredibly dangerous group that's growing. It's 2.5 times what it was 10 years ago. So it's growing and it's actually infecting the way that we see everything. So financial organisations, like every other organisation, has to be aware that while there'll be people who love you, your customers will love you, they'll be giving you a 10 on your net promoter score, some of them, it's the others that you don't understand how hurt, how angry, how fractious they feel about anyone who's doing okay. And they will be an incredibly important group to understand going forward.
That's very interesting. Just to follow up on that, I mean, are we talking politically affected there people as well? Or is it more just people at the end of their wick?
They're more likely to vote for Pauline Hanson. They're more 2.5 times more likely to vote One Nation. Yeah. It manifests itself politically, but it also it manifests as much in terms of anger at banks, anger at supermarkets. You know, anger at supermarkets that are charging for food. So this is a very, very powerful and frightening small group. The sovereign citizen kind of group that we're seeing emerging. And it kind of makes a huge difference as we want to push forward in terms of new technology or any kind of innovation or any kind of social issue. Is, you know, this group want to know nothing about that. And they're very, very powerful. Well, they're powerful in their degree of hatred, and they're a growing group.
It's very interesting. I think we'll come back to technology very shortly. But I just wanted to ask Alan, trust can be a nebulous concept, but how does it link to perhaps the legal obligations of firms operating in this sector? Because, you know, we've heard about shareholder value, you know, lots of rules and regulations, but, you know, how do you weave trust into these?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, you won't find consumer trust in the sense we're talking about it here in the ASIC Act or the Corporations Act, but there are some pretty good pointers there. I mean, just some of those core obligations that apply to pretty much everybody in the financial services sector. I mean, don't mislead or deceive your customers. Don't have standard contracts that have got unfair terms in them. Don't engage in unconscionable conduct. you know, go about your business if you've got a license efficiently, honestly, and fairly. I mean, all of those things are in the discrete obligations, but when you strip them back, they're about doing the right thing by your customers. So give them what you told them you would give them, charge them the price you said you would charge them, and if something goes wrong, deal with it. And I think if businesses really strip it back and focus on that, those basic principles of treating their customers right, not only will they be complying with their legal obligations, but they'll also be less likely to end up in a situation that has a big impact on trust.
Great. Excellent. Probably one for the other end of the stage now, but I was going to ask about external factors as opposed to what's in a company's control. Let's start with Steve. How do you manage this trust issue with in an industry as dynamic as insurance in an extreme climate?
Well, there's plenty of things external that can cause trouble for me. Even this weekend, with some forward forecasts on weather, so. Weather's a big variable for us. And obviously, this is our job. Our job is to put people back into their homes. And I think one of the big things I learned out of 2022, where we had 55,000 claims, it's a lot of claims across the course of a year. And, during that period of time, I could wander around saying, we're 98% complete. And we'd all pat each other on the back and everyone would say, that's a great job, off you go. But 2% of 55,000, it's a big number. And there's people out of their homes for 12 to 18 months. And I, think we spend a lot of time on the 98%. Whenever I'd go out and meet with customers, it'd typically be in that 98%. And post-2022, now I spend my time in the 2%. Because they need to be unlocked, they're complex, they're difficult, et cetera, et cetera. And they're usually the result of a lot of externalities, people that have built or bought in areas they should never have been allowed to build or buy in, and we got to try and fix that place up, knowing full well that in another 10 years or so, there's going to be another life-changing event for those customers. So I think that's the key differential. We've turned from the 98% to the 2%, and I think that's just representative of the whole industry.
It's a human, isn't it?
I was out last week post the storms in Brisbane. And I walk into a house and the roof has collapsed with a gum tree that's fallen on it. There's the breakfast that they'd been eating is still on the table. There's lizards crawling around the house. It's just traumatic. And we often calculate the cost of weather and natural hazards in dollar terms, but it's a multiple of that when you put the trauma in there. And, when I go out there and I sit down with people, and it's a reflective of the insurance industry more broadly, you see the distress and the trauma and the pain and the suffering and all of that stuff proximate to the water coming through the house. And then you walk around the house and you go out the back and in a Tupperware tub with some solution in it, there's pictures that of the children when they're born trying to recover them. They've been mud strong. I mean, that just brings you back to reality. And then you sit down with them, and I do it quite anonymously. They're prepared for an adversary, and this is going to be tough. The insurers, going to be disposed to not do this claim or cut a corner or do something. And that's an indictment on the industry that people start from that proposition. And when I take the keys back, it's, far more friendly and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that you can do all the research you like and it's all important data. But until such time as people reflect confidence in the industry and what it needs to do, and that they pay a premium and they should get their repair done, I think that's the measure for me.
It's really good to hear you focus on that 2% piece. I think insurance is a great example when we're talking about what industries can control and what they can't. We can't expect insurers to control the weather, although I do think the insurers are taking some real leadership stances in trying to raise, this is an issue we all have to pay attention to. Climate change is here. Disasters are going to be more frequent. They're going to be worse. One of the most important things I do with my time, I chair ARC Justice. It's a community legal centre in northern Victoria. It covers my hometown of Shepparton. It also covers Rochester. These are towns that have flooded very seriously in recent years, and they will flood again. We can't expect insurers to stop the floods, but what we can expect is that they get the basics right. And I think that basics piece is what you were picking up. where ArcJustice still sees issues is on those basics. Working with clients whose house flooded in 2022, they still see issues of claims delays. And quite often it's things like there are externalities there, tradie availability it's a challenge, responsiveness is a challenge. Disasters have just gone through these towns. Getting people in and getting help is really hard work. But where there's delays caused by insurers, that's where this is really frustrating. And that's failure to respond to emails, it's failure to return phone calls, it's hours waiting on the phone from someone who's already in a really distressing situation just to get a basic response. The insurance sector still needs to work on that core customer service muscle. And the other piece is how you communicate to customers before there's a disaster. In Shepparton right now, the community is seeing really different prices, sometimes from the same insurer, and they don't know why. Communities talk to each other. They've figured this out, that there's something going on here. But what they're not hearing from insurers is, you have a higher risk because of this specific factor. Or even better would be, you can take control and reduce your risk by doing X or Y. We know insurers have this data. There's a role to help them work with communities to take action against risk. Sometimes that's really, really hard choices about helping communities relocate, but it can also be about practical steps. Right now, I'm seeing people in Shepparton, they're just getting a higher dollar on a bill. And that doesn't help them have trust that the sector's got their back and will be with them when there's the next flood.
Absolutely. And just to follow up, Steve, you said since 2022 you focused more on that 2%. What can the industry do? Is this a product, a pricing, a communication issue? Is it you getting down there on the ground? Because presumably pre-2022 you would go to these places and talk to people. So what is it about the last 3 years?
Look,
that has changed and has forced you to change?
I'm not a pleasant person in the insurance industry, because I do think, you know, the products we sell today are the same products we sold 50 years ago, and, you know, they need to evolve. And some of the impediment to that are the core systems that we've got, which are very limited in our ability to do some of the things that insurance is going to have to do in the future. But, you know, and there's complexity in these claims. I mean, insurance is not a maintenance product. But because Australia had, inverted commas, reasonably cheap insurance for a decade, because global reinsurers mispriced Australia, it was able to extend into quasi-maintenance. It can't do that anymore. So we will get bogged down with issues around maintenance and all that sort of thing, but consistently in the 2% that I talk to and listen to and try and resolve, communication and judgment. You know, people sort of, you know, can accept reluctantly outcomes as long as you talk to them and you meet the requirements that we have in the code around timelines. They get really frustrated when they aren't spoken to. Surprise, surprise. So yes, we can build a new product, we can do a lot of things differently, and we need to, but just getting the basics of communication and making good judgment calls as a relative to the law, our claims handling requirements, the code, and various other issues, I think will go a long way to improving some of that trust.
Our research shows that transparency is really critical, and speak truth told simply. You know, you talked about talking to people, but maybe you can't talk to everyone, but any communication that goes to people, get rid of the spin. Spin is so dangerous. You know, keeping it simple will help enormously. And, you know, every time I listen to you, I hear something that makes me understand the challenges of the insurance industry more. I don't think that you can tell the average person who's about to buy insurance all of your problems, but you can actually explain exactly why their policy is what it is or what they can choose. Absolutely right.
I do think it's worth picking up here. I really love that you've called out the communications piece. There's an extra piece here around when someone's making a claim. There's a power imbalance inherent with insurance. It's a complex product. Most of us don't understand it. We couldn't if we tried. Quite often where we see real challenges is when there's different interpretations of key terms. We have a standard definition, but only for flood. And we also see particular issues around maintenance, wear and tear, stumps in flood areas. Quite often what I see with these 2% cases where they get bogged down, an insurer comes in and says, no, we're not going to do this, or we'll only offer you a partial cash-only payout. They're not explaining the evidence that they've used to come to that conclusion. A consumer's just pretty much in a take-it-or-leave-it position. And of course that's frustrating. insurers need to keep in mind they know more about their product. They know more about the evidence and how they've made that claim. And if they're working with customers to make the tough calls, they've got to do more to make sure that evidence is translated or at minimum provided to the people who are on the receiving end of trying to recover.
And just, I mean, I'm conscious, Nick, I feel sorry for Steve because this wasn't meant to be a panel about insurance.
I'm well trained.
But there are some really interesting, I think, themes that are relevant across the sector. So that issue around getting the basics right and communication, I mean, they're issues that come up in so many other areas of our work. So if you look at all of the work we've done on lenders' responses to people in financial hardship in recent years, both our regulatory work, the big report we put out last year, but also the significant enforcement action we've taken, a lot of that's actually grounded in banks and other lenders simply not responding within the time frame that's required. And these are responding to very vulnerable people. You look at the work we've done around super funds responding to death benefit claims, again, really long delays, often with poor communication along the way. So there are other areas of concern to us, which are also areas of significant public interest and concern. You see similar risks that, you know, if firms can really focus on getting those basics right, communicating in a timely manner, not just meeting their obligations, but stepping outside of that and keeping people up to date about where a claim or a request is up to, but also communicating in a way that people understand is really critical to maintaining and ultimately rebuilding trust.
I mean, don't feel too sorry for me because, I'm sure you don't, but, you know, I've been following two claims out of the cyclone in southeast Queensland. A lady in her 70s, early 80s, I think she is, can't speak English. A tree fell through the roof of the house, you know, massive tree. She's huddled into a bedroom with her granddaughter. The house, it was hand-built by her deceased husband. Then another family at Redland Bay where the roof, again, tree goes through the roof. There's a four-month-old and a four-year-old. Can you imagine that mother, as she went from the bedroom, not understanding what was going to be in confronting her? Those two clients, I have the opportunity to take those keys and give them back to them. And what does that mean? That is so uplifting. What other ASX CEO has that opportunity to do that? So yes, you know, we do a lot of things less than perfectly, but gee, when we do it well, it makes a huge difference to those two families. If we get them in before Christmas, one of them's living with their in-laws, and she doesn't like living with her in-laws. And I peeled her aside, and she had tears in her eyes and said, "Can you please get me out by Christmas?" So I've made it, on all the things I'm doing, you know, half-year results and all that sort of stuff, my number one objective is to get that family in their home by Christmas. Mm. And that's a big difference for them.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I was actually going to, this question disappeared, but it was a really good question from the audience about compliance. Here it is. From Emma, so Emma Curtis saying, complaints to the AFC about insurance are up 50%, increased 50% after 2022, but they haven't come down. What does this indicate about consumer trust in that specific sector, and how should you respond? I want to start with Erin there, actually, because we talked just before about that, and that might not indicate what we think it does.
Yeah, look, I think there's a customer service piece here, and it is around the basics. How are you responding? How are you communicating? Of course, insurance sector will face spikes in complaints when there's a crisis, but I think we know now that crises are becoming sadly more normal. We're past some of these crises, and we're still seeing high complaint numbers at AFCA. This, to me, says there's this underlying problem around just responsiveness, customer care, people trusting that the insurer is listening to them and working with them. So there's more to do on those real core functions of being a good business that cares for your customers and focuses on getting people back in their homes by Christmas. I wish more organizations had that focus, because that's the kind of thing, that proactive stance. How do I work with my customers? How do I make things right? That's, I think, when you don't get that right, you see numbers like AFCA's seeing.
Very good. And, I guess there is an element here of if people aren't complaining, it might indicate a distrust, as Michelle was saying, that they're just not bothering to complain, which might be terrible for the company, but also for the industry in general. Right?
Yeah, so can I say insurance in terms of trust and distrust is on the improve? So it's still a bit more distrusted than trusted, but it's actually on the improve. And so when I look at numbers like that, I kind of go, gee, that's just one piece of the puzzle. Because when, if people can't complain, like if you can't get through and make a complaint, that's worse. But if you can make complaints, they are often the point at which you're able to explain, fix the problem, turn people around. But, you know, it's all very well for us to naively say we should fix everybody's problem immediately and be as friendly as the wonderful woman on the phone when you get stuck and the RACV, you know, tells you exactly they're going to come and look after you. It's not that simple. You know, there are big systems sitting behind these organisations. If they wanted to change things really quickly, it's just not that easy. So there's enormous number of things that need to happen. And what we're talking about is trying to, while all of that work is done, to make things more productive and efficient and therefore good in reality, is to be transparent about it, to have a decency principle when dealing with people, and try and take the, you know, the people of Australia with us, whatever organisation we're in, as we get faster and better and more able to do what needs to be done.
I flagged that I wanted to touch on this. This is good news for the insurance sector, by the way, where I'm heading. Complaints are really important, but I think it's worth keeping in mind as a sector who isn't coming to you and who isn't telling you about their problems. Basically, you don't want to be where the telecommunications sector is today. And that is in part, they are lurching from crisis to crisis to crisis right now. There's not this sense that there's an industry leadership to address these big problems or really regulatory action to address big problems. But more than that, what we're seeing when we look at our data is people aren't raising complaints. They don't trust businesses enough to tell them when something goes wrong. And for me, that's such a warning sign that this sector's got it wrong. And it's where I don't want the financial services sector to be ever again. So right now we know that over half of Australians have a problem with their mobile phone or their internet connection. 46% of people don't raise a complaint. And that's a problem. Companies, even companies who go today, right, let's fix this, let's get on top of things. What are people telling us about complaints? They have this legacy issue where people have gone, no, last time I called my telco, I was on the phone for 3 hours. They didn't help me. It was frustrating. I'll never do it again. It's not worth my time. So it's worth keeping an eye on the complaints piece. It's also worth going out and proactively measuring, well, who's not telling us about our problems? Because if you can get that proactive stance right, I think it's a great way to think about how do I make sure I'm doing the right thing for my customers all the time. Just don't be the telco sector.
Just as a side, I mean, I think we should say, I mean, everyone was talking about insurance complaints data there, but I think in general, we should see the growth in complaints to AFCA as a positive thing.
Yeah.
Sign that people have some trust in that complaints system, that you know, their complaint will be considered and hopefully determined in their perception fairly. So I think if we were, given all the economic forces at play, if we were seeing AFCA complaints stable or declining, it'd be raising different questions. But I think it's a positive thing that people think there is value in complaining if they perceive a problem.
Great. Within reason, though, probably.
Yeah, but I mean, AFCA then determines it, you know, based on its rules and appropriately. But I think the first step is people having faith in this.
And I'll bring back that other really important point, and that's that distrust is more important than trust. And poor customer service is, like, not good, but it sort of plays into that trust area. But real shenanigans, stealing from people, consistently setting up systems to steal from people, consistently doing things that are evil or having the perception that companies are doing that, that's what kicks in with distrust. That's the killer. I mean, you know, you can work on gradually improving your trust, your customer service, you know, your net promoter score, all of those kinds of things. And everyone's, you know, so focused on their net promoter score. That's a score from sort of 0 to 10. It doesn't actually take into account those people who are so angry, so disgusted with the way that an industry or an organization has been operating, that they are really, you know, ready to hit the road and run, ready to hit the social networks, and ready to bring the organization down. So, you know, I just think we should, in industry, be thinking a lot more about that risk of distrust, the real evil, the secrets that an organization just hopes nobody's going to find out about. A little bit like, you know, it's like cancer. You don't know you've got it, it can really bring you down. But if you're always looking out for it, you can deal with it and do something about it. So we shouldn't be so hung up on, you know, customer service and things. Important, but not the real killer.
That's an interesting point. We were also talking in the previous session about AI. I think we're going to hear a lot more about that over the next couple of days. But it's becoming quite a negative panel. But AI also has the capacity to generate a lot of distrust in terms of how information is used, the social impact of that. What is the research saying about how this is affecting, how data use is affecting trust in individual firms? Maybe start with Aaron.
Well, look, on the AI piece, I think it's moving quickly. There's organizations implementing AI right now that looks different to what it looked like a few months ago. So it's hard to get on top of the research here. I will say I've got some big questions as a think tank. The questions we're asking are things like, is AI use compliant with the law? The current laws we have, for example, I know we've seen it in a few survey pieces now that people are using generalist chat-based AI for financial, essentially what I'd say financial advice. Where should I invest? What's the best super fund, etc. I genuinely want to know, is this captured by our current laws? Is it compliant with the current laws? These are the kind of things we need to keep coming back to and testing. It's as much about the behavior of the financial services industry that I think are extremely aware of their obligations here, and I hope fully compliant, as it is new players that are wandering into these spaces and may not even realize that they're being caught by the law. This is a sector that moves fast and breaks things. I want to catch the things before they break as a consumer advocate, and I'm really worried about this piece. In terms of data and digital, though, there's another sleeper issue that's worth keeping in mind, and that's about how our data is shared as consumers between industries. This is something that it's so commonplace in corporate Australia, and it's where I see a real gulf between what consumers expect and want and industry practices and the law. Our Privacy Act is nearly older than me, which dates me, but it's not good. Our Privacy Act, it was formed before the internet. It's so out of pace with modern consumer expectations and modern practices with the internet. We know it's incredibly common for people's details to be shared, contact details, behaviours online. And there are real risks in a financial services context around this. Again, I'm going to go point to Shield and First Guardian Master Trusts. That starts with lead generation. It starts with companies collecting people's emails and passing them on to other parties. And that's, you can track that all the way to people having a real risk to their retirement savings. Industry need to be aware not just of AI, but how you are collecting and sharing consumer data in ways that really have the potential to cause harm.
Very good.
Can I say from our research, AI is likely to cause the end of the human race within the next 20 years, according to 25% of the population. That's a lot. That's one in four, and that's up 5% in just 2 years. And 65% of people in Australia think that AI causes more problems than it solves. So 35% today think that it solves more problems than it creates. So the negative's going up. That's up 8% in 2 years. So we're anxious as a nation. We're anxious. And yet many, many of the things that we've been talking about here will actually be facilitated by AI. You know, if the people dealing with claims had immediate access to all of the information about those individual people, what was available on the ground, how best to handle it, it would be, you guys would love to do that. You're not sitting there thinking, how can we be difficult? How can we take too long? Nobody's doing that. So AI has magical ways forward, but it is not something that we as a nation are at one with completely. And it's really interesting when I had a conversation, I think you made the point and sort of stopped me in my tracks. You said, oh, well, people always feel like that about any new technology. Was that you?
Probably so.
It was him. I knew it was one of the white blokes. But it made me
think. You didn't say middle age.
No, I did. Did you notice? I stopped. It made me think about it though, and I thought, it's right, but it's not AI. It's not like the wheel. It's not like the internet. It's not like any of those other you're learning flying. It's different. And the thing that's, to me, it's closest to is IVF. when we started to look at, you know, test tube babies, IVF, the issue was now creating life. And if you can remember back to those times when it wasn't happening, you know, all the time, the world, except for Australia, stopped and said, this is an ethical issue. And there were conversations, there were all sorts of considerations about the ethics of creating life, choosing life. Where would we put the boundaries? I mean, interestingly, Australia had always supported IVF. And while the world was looking at whether it was a good thing or a bad thing or how do we control it, Australia kind of just kept on going. But I raise the point because I think AI is like that. It's a really, really big game changer. I mean, I'm almost in that 25% of people that think it could cause the end of the world. But I think we definitely need to look at it from all angles. And it is making, we're already seeing lots of issues that we had never anticipated. But, you know, for good, for the things we've been talking about, amazing, amazing.
I mean, I having said that comment, let me just clarify it. I guess if you went back through the digital era at some point, there would be a subset of the population who thought digitization was going to be the end of the world as well. And I accept AI is different, for sure. When I started in this job, we were originating sales, service and claims lodgement 80% on the phone, 20% digitally. That was 5 years ago. I said to the organisation, what would have to happen for us to turn those numbers over? So that's 80% digital, 20%. And I was laughed down. Never going to happen. Insurance, too complex. No one wants to engage with their insurer over digital means. They want to do it on the phone. Last week, we had in AAMI 90% of our sales online. 90. The week before, when we had that big event in Southeast Queensland, 85% of people lodged their claim online. The next generation of digital will be all the way through. So sales, service, claims, not just lodging your claim, managing your claim through. And there'll be a subset of people who won't appreciate that. And so we'll have maybe 10% of the workforce focus, supporting the people, but doing it on a higher capability level, dealing with vulnerability, all the things that have to be done for those people. And AI will be a continuum as well. I mean, today in AI terms, you know, we've got people using AI to take a voluminous claim file. Like it might be that thick as it goes from one person to the next through the production line. And AI consolidating all of that in seconds so that the person who picks up the claim doesn't have to review the claim file that thick. They just pick up the one page and they move forward. And that's going to be to the betterment of the customer.
Yeah.
So I think you can take the AI extreme cases to, you know, there will be the advice areas and everything. But it will revolutionise insurance. It will revolutionise it, and I think largely to the betterment of the consumer, as long as we do it properly and as long as the law, as it will evolve to make sure that it is not misused.
And I think I largely agree with Steve on the opportunity side, and insurance is one of the sectors where I think that's easiest to see and imagine. But I also think, what our work sort of shows is we're sort of at a really critical point in financial services where firms are now really only starting to think about using AI in ways that can really have an impact on the outcomes for their consumers. And that's where the risk side comes in. So where it can go wrong is if something happened, the consumers didn't realise AI was being used and they feel like their trust has been breached there. If there are issues around how data is being used or there are data breach issues, or if you end up with particular cohorts of consumers who are getting different and lesser outcomes in a way that is actually or is perceived to be unfair. And so I say that just because I think it's all about being conscious of those risks. And I mean, our view is under existing laws, they provide pretty good guidance about how to think about that. So from the very beginning, think about, be clear about how AI is being used, be clear about where the risks are, be clear about the governance processes, and be clear about how you're actually measuring the impact and particularly the consumer outcomes, and adjust your approach where you see problems. If you're doing all of those things, once again, you're probably going to be complying with your obligations or of less concern to us if something goes wrong, but also less likely to end up in a situation where you've got a big trust problem.
Gotcha. I'm going to turn to another question from the floor here because it sort of dovetails with partly what Steve said before. Drew McRae asks, we've heard the system's excuse from insurers for years, decades, given the profitability of the sector, why you're not uplifting your systems. But I'll ask in a slightly different way, given the AI question. You said before that the product has been fairly moribund or static for a long time. Then you were talking there about the ability of AI to speed up and, you know, add value to the processing. So is this a rebuttal or?
No, it's true. I mean, I don't use it as an excuse. I mean, if someone pays a premium for us to repair their home, you can't stand there and say, oh, our systems don't work properly. I mean, we shouldn't collect the premium if that's the case. My point is that, we're operating, generally the incumbent insurers have historically operated off systems that are 30 or 40 years old, COBOL-based, you know, things that were going on when I was at university. And they're just not equipped for the future of insurance. And we're all going through now. We're spending, you know, $650 million a year, each year, to upgrade those systems. And we are in the process of doing it because insurance will be hyper-personalised. We will know more about your property, and this is going to throw forward a series of other challenges for the sector and regulators and others. We'll know more about your property than you will. Today, I can go to every single person in this room against the 9 perils that go into the hazard sort of component of a premium. You know, bushfire, flood, cyclone, 9 of them. And we aggregate them up, and that, you know, that's all based on modelling. Over time, I'll be able to tell you, using AI and other tools, the quality of your soil. I'll know what the quality of your roof is, the pitch of your roof, the quality of your roof, tiles, colour bond, et cetera, et cetera. And then inside the home, that little vacuum cleaner that rolls around the home will be taking pictures of all your sums insured, and we'll be driving that straight into our sum insured calculator, straight into your premium. It'll turn off your water when there's a leak. It'll put out the fire when there's a lithium battery explodes. Now, if you're going to spend $30,000 or $40,000 on all of that, you're going to want to monetize it, aren't you? You're going to want to say, well, if I'm doing that, my neighbor doesn't, why should I pay the same premium as them? And so that's going to be a challenge, because those people that can afford to do it will get the lower premium, and will have the same issue as those people who built and bought in areas they shouldn't, but inside the home. So the systems that we've had will never be able to work in that era. So they have to be upgraded, and systems aren't an excuse.
It's a good old carrot and stick argument, though, isn't it? The more you can actually inform people about the risks that they particularly have and the things that they could do differently, the more you're able to support them, but also not allow them to get away with it.
Ooh, that's a bit of a loaded sentence. Look, I really want to pick up on this, because there's two challenges for consumers and industry here. First is personalised pricing or dynamic pricing, hyper-personalised pricing that we're talking about here. I can see that insurance is going to be the first sector that goes that way. It's going to immediately lead us to an equity conversation. There are groups of people who, even if they have the information about what they can do to lower their risk, will not be able to afford to. We're going to have to really look this in the eye. Is insurance here to pool risk and move together as Australia or as a region? Should people in flood zones, who are by trend people on the lowest incomes in Australia, these are the only places they can currently afford to buy. It's not a choice made because there's lots of other options. We need to think about the equity implications of this now before the sector gets there. But more than this, there's something in this world around hyper data collection. Now, I don't think consumers are actually opposed to lots of data collection. We've got to get into a discussion around, well, how is this data used? Is it for my benefit or is it going to hurt me? Is it passed on to other parties? Is it kept safe? There's a lot of challenges in this future world that we're going to have to get on top of now, ideally before the disasters to come that could happen if we get it wrong.
But it is absolutely the case that, you know, there's a high correlation between those people, the socioeconomic status of those people who built and bought in an area that's high flood risk. So they're getting the highest premium. And on top of that high premium, and they bought that home or they built that home with all relevant approvals, they get the high premium. On top of that, they get the GST proportionally. They get the stamp duty proportional and a New South Wales Emergency Services Levy. So they're not only punished through the cost of their insurance, the primary cost of it, they're punished 3 times in the tax system. And so, you know, we've got to get better at thinking about how we use the tax system, not only to punish people, but to do the sorts of things and subsidise the people to upgrade the quality of their own home so that they can get the premium where it needs to be and affordable. And then stop building homes in areas that shouldn't be built in. You know, we've made this mistake 100, 150 years. And now with the housing crisis, of availability of housing crisis, we're going to do it all again. Yeah. So we've got to stop that. We can stop the rot, and then we can deal with some of the bigger issues around resilience mitigation, subsidies to allow people to upgrade the quality of their home and get tax reform. They're big issues for the country.
Very good. Are you confident the government's on top of this? Because as you said, we have different priorities across different departments, and each week seems to thing. And you mentioned sort of housing.
The four things I talked about. So the first one, resilience and mitigation, we've had progress. So previous 5 years ago, 97 cents in the dollar, mopping up 3 cents in the dollar, mitigating, it's now 93 cents versus seven. So good, that's good progress, I think, or relatively good progress. We've got to get to 50-50. That's $30 billion over 10 years. Hard to see that's going to come through the budget. Using the tax system and other subsidies to get people to upgrade the quality of home, limited progress, but there's opportunities to do it. Land planning, we did a forum in Canberra last week. Everyone's talking the right talk, but it's interjurisdictional, it's intergeographic. One talks points to the other one, and tax reform. Well,
but these things are really interesting, aren't they? Because if everything was going to be done in these places where it's much less expensive to go live, and then all of a sudden they were de-risked, they'd become more expensive to live there.
Right.
So, it's not like the Prime Minister's just got blinders on. It's just not a simple problem.
No, it's not. We've had the Minister, everyone's minded to, they understand the problem.
Yeah.
Not so we're talking to people who don't understand the problem, but, one points to the state, they can't take any of these taxes off, obviously, so they point to the Commonwealth. And we just go around in circles, and every day there's housing approvals for houses that we know are going to flood. 5 or 10 years' time, they're going to flood, and the premium has to reflect that.
Mm.
Very good. I was going to ask about one for Alan, because we haven't said that thing for a while. as a regulator, it's part of your job to maintain trust in the system. And I guess there is possibly a blowback as well, because people need to trust ASIC as well. So, we've all been talking to and at Steve here as the industry representative. But, how does the regulator sort of improve trust in society and ensure that it doesn't come back at you when something goes horrendously wrong?
Oh, I think... I think it is really, we do play an important role. I mean, just as I was saying earlier, people need to have trust in their ability to make a complaint and the value of making a complaint if they're dissatisfied. They need to feel that that firms are held to their, and individuals in the sector are held to their obligations, and there are consequences where they don't, and it causes significant consumer harm. And I guess the way you see us working in ways that help with that are by taking on some of those matters of really significant public interest where there is evidence of harm and people are concerned about that. So the work, some of which I mentioned already on financial hardship. So particularly in recent years, we saw a significant increase in people who had credit products reaching out to their institutions, asking for hardship assistance. They're legally entitled to get a response, and we were concerned they were not getting the response that they were entitled to get. Really significant enforcement action with some significant civil penalties, more action underway, and we've also driven a lot of change across that sector. We've talked a lot already about our work on insurance claims. The work on superannuation death benefits I only touched on earlier, but for people who aren't familiar with what I'm talking about there, if somebody who's got money in super dies, their dependents often really need access to the death benefits from their fund. And when we looked at what was happening there and saw people waiting many, many months, sometimes more than 12 months to get those benefits paid out, facing really onerous processes and super trustees are really without having their eye on the ball to even understand that this was a problem, despite it coming through in complaints. That's another issue where we've done the regulatory work, we've talked about it quite publicly, and we've got enforcement action underway. And so I think, you know, acting on those issues of significant public interest is an important part of it, backing it with serious enforcement action. And to be honest, just speaking much more plainly about the harms we're seeing and what we're doing in response, because that's intended to not only help the public to understand that we're acting on issues of significant public interest, it's also intended to drive change in behaviour across the sector so that less people experience those sorts of problems in the future.
Good. Again, another great question here about social media, which I threw to at the start. Greg wants to know, with the increase in social media and the ease of access and the ability of people to lie, complain, shout, scream, what impact is that having on reputational damage compared to in the past where perhaps it was
huge,
collated?
Huge and escalating.
Yeah. Well, how does a company deal with it, I guess?
Sorry?
How does a company deal with it if you're trying to rebuild or maintain trust and you go onto Twitter and, you know, search for your corporate name and see what's on there? I mean, is that just background noise or?
You know, once it's on Twitter or X or any other thing and it's gone crazy, it's a really bad place to be. But what we would say, very much what you were talking about earlier, is that to focus on those people that are really distrusting. Always have an eye on the people who are distrusting. Why are they? What are the problems? How do we fix them? Try and deal with them. Nip it in the bud. If it's too late and something you've done something really bad and, you know, it's taken to the Twitter sphere, then basically you've got to be totally in recovery mode. And, you know, what our data shows is it often takes, it can take, you know, up to 7 years to recover from that kind of thing. So there's not an easy fix. You can't just ring up Elon Musk and say, stop those people saying mean things about me. Pretty much anything you do at that point is going to be looked at through a lens of distrust and, you know, disbelief, all of those things. So you have to have a really clear way of working out what it is you're going to say. If you've done something wrong, apologise. Be very clear about how you're going to compensate, change your ways, make real clear promises and stick to them, and then report to the market, to the world, how you're actually going.
Nick, I would say people are more likely to go to social media if they don't think they'll get a response through the traditional channels. So actually having really good quality IDR processes where you're actually encouraging people to complain, you're acting on what you're saying, you're addressing the systemic issues so less people get frustrated and complain is really key to trying to prevent them going to social media in the first place.
I mean, I mean, reputational issues are obviously front and centre in this discussion, but AI changes the complete dynamic around how companies market, how their brands work, how their sales activity works. You know, in the day it was, you know, above the line advertising, sponsorships, et cetera, that was your marketing budget. It then evolved to search engine marketing and search engine optimization, where you wanted to be at the top of the Google search. Going forward, you know, these AI tools will, some of what's the best insurance product? And where they get that data from, you know, will be on a continuum of good, bad, and ugly. You know, I could go out and spend $10,000 with XYZ magazine and become the insurer of the year. And if the AI bot drives down that into the search engine, that's the easiest way to do it. So we've got this evolution, I think, of the way that not only people think about the reputation and the brand of an organisation, it's about how they actually buy the product.
And sort of, because the next thing is they will be actually buying
it. They will buy the product based on XYZ Magazine's award for Insurer of the Year, which I've just paid $10,000 to get and put me on the cover as the CEO of the year. So,
only 10 grand?
Well, I don't know, whatever the cost is, but you get my point. I mean, it's not necessarily the best reflection of the quality of the insurance company that they're going to be putting their trust in.
Yeah.
I think it's worth calling out, there's actually a trust issue here on social media and digital platforms. This is a sector that is being disrupted and is changing rapidly. Twitter X is a great example. If I got asked this question 5 years ago, I'd say absolutely, really pay attention to Twitter. Complaints there probably are coming from the general public. With AI, there's more chatbots and fake accounts than ever. More people are leaving the platform because it's, I'd say, bot central, and the actual humans that remain on it are, I think, more likely to be that really disaffected, angry group that we talked about earlier. We're also seeing a real consumers can't trust the ads they see on social media. This is where there are serious scams, ghost stores, or lead generators pushing a free super health check that then suddenly gets you into a high-risk product. So as any party here engaging in advertising on those platforms, you need to be really aware that you're participating in an ecosystem that has lower and lower trust by the day because people are being scammed, they're being harmed. And it's going to affect legitimate businesses as well. The way just even a few years ago you were reaching big, broad groups of people, people are increasingly switching off and feeling like they can't trust it. My message to my parents is get off Facebook. Please click on nothing. Because I can guarantee they're going to end up in a crypto scam. That's what where we're at with these digital platforms. So we need to think about how trusted sectors play with sectors that are behaving in ways where they are rightly losing trust.
Well, I think we've hit the buffer of time. So thank you very much for your thoughts, a very lively discussion, and good to consider the consumer in this very dynamic world. Don't take a route.